Actually, probably the bigger deal is my full chat history as opposed to necessarily what's being stored in the memory itself. I don't think the memory thing is just such a big deal.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to another episode of Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a group of researchers, product leaders, and business minds working at the very frontiers of artificial intelligence to discuss and debate the week's news. On this week's episode, we have Gabe Goodhart, Chief Architect, AI Open Innovation, Chris Hay, Distinguished Engineer, and Aaron Bautman, IBM Fellow and Master Inventor. All veterans to the show, welcome back. I love this panel. We have another packed episode today. As always, we're going to talk a little bit about Claude import memory. We'll talk a little bit about this NullClaw project that's been getting a bunch of buzz. And we will also talk about the case of a fully AI actor that is making the rounds. But I really want to start today with the announcement of a new feature from Perplexity, something they're calling Perplexity Computer. Like many other companies, they're all jumping into the agent game. And what Perplexity Computer purports to do is to orchestrate a number of agents to do whatever you want to get done. And so I kind of want to bring this up because obviously we've been tracking the kind of OpenClaw sort of arc over the last few episodes. And, you know, I'd venture almost to say that we're now in the kind of like post OpenClaw moments, where I think a bunch of other players are jumping in and they're trying to make their own mark on the space. And so I guess, Chris, maybe I'll start with you. I mean, for Perplexity Computer, you know, Perplexity, you know, I think we were talking to them about them a year ago in the context of like, oh, this is a replacement for search. They really seem to be going in a pretty different direction now with something like this. Is like search even the right way to still think about these products anymore?
I think search is still the right way to think of these products. And I know that's an odd thing to say, but if we really think about what this is about, which is agent orchestration, then search becomes a kind of key part of that, which is you need to have the knowledge bases. If we look at, you know, we're going to talk about OpenClaw and stuff like that as well. Again, the ability to search and be able to get results back quickly and then interact with the other systems and orchestrate becomes important. So I think Perplexity have went in a direction to begin with, which was, can we create the fastest search engine, et cetera? Then they obviously went with the native browser. You know, what they're really doing is trying to build you an end-to-end agentic platform where all of these elements come together. And so, you know, and search is one of those components. And of course, they want to come in the glass there, which is the Perplexity search. But obviously, they want to branch out and sort of own as much of that agent orchestration space as they can.
Gabe, I think one of the big things they're touting for Perplexity Computer, and I think this is kind of how everybody has been trying to like eat OpenClaw's lunch, is don't trust these open systems. They're very insecure and can ruin your computer. And so for Perplexity Computer, they basically say, look, it runs in the cloud, not in your local machine. That's a degree of safety. And it's also going to be like specifically in a curated list of integrations. And so I guess I am kind of curious, as someone who works on kind of open ecosystems in the space, like, do closed kind of approaches to this kind of win in the end? Or are you still pretty bullish on kind of OpenClaw and like the wide open space of skills being like really how like the kind of like ecosystem evolves over time?
Yeah. So I think the initially when I was reading about this, it really struck me as a little jarring to compare it directly to OpenClaw, only because I think some of the things that actually made the OpenClaw moment are not present in Perplexity Computer. So I think the kernel of what Perplexity Computer is trying to do here is manage extremely long-running tasks that are very sort of high order in nature. And it's doing that by breaking it down into a handful of sub-agents. And that part is directly similar to OpenClaw. But I think what really made OpenClaw have its moment was, as dumb as it sounds, the addition of a for loop, right? The addition of cron jobs, and that for loop had a self-improvement aspect to it. So it actually tried to sort of curate almost a persona for your OpenClaw bot. And I think that part, you know, may not have had a whole lot of utility to it, but it certainly started capturing the imagination and personified these things in a way that just having a long-running agent doesn't. So in that respect, I think it's not a direct analogy to OpenClaw. But to your question about sort of open systems versus closed systems, just for the nature of this long-running task, I think it's not actually about open versus closed. It's about building chain of trust. And that can happen in an open ecosystem or a closed ecosystem. And fundamentally, this is absolutely no different than the discussion about open source software versus closed source software. The thing is, the thing that actually has the security profile that it could be risky is now a big pile of text instead of a piece of software that you're downloading from GitHub or any other repository. So the real danger that came about with OpenClaw, there were a handful of dangerous aspects to it. There was unfettered access to your computer. Okay, so they're mitigating that one. But OpenClaw has its own sandboxing. So that's basically no different there. You can run it in a Docker container sandboxed and it's fine. The next risk is giving it too much permission with destructive capabilities. And that is fundamentally no different if Perplexity Computer were given access to, say, your personal Gmail or your personal X, Y, and Z. If it's given delete access, it can choose to do that, sandboxed or not. It can just make the wrong decision. So that part is not mitigated. The third part is the risk of prompt injection. And there's two vectors for that. There's the community of skills. And that's the part that I think Perplexity Computer is trying to mitigate with this curated list of integrations. That's really important. I think that's something that the open community will tackle and in fact already is. If you look at skill.sh, you'll see that all the skills are rated by Sneak and they have basically the same level of inspection you would see on a curated Docker Hub type of ecosystem or a curated open source repository package where you've got some, trust badge associated with it and some type of scanning associated with the source. So there's that aspect of it, but then there's also like a chain of trust you could apply to it. The final thing is prompt injection from the raw content that comes from literally anywhere. If these agents are going to go scrape the web, there's absolutely nothing preventing web page X, Y, and Z from hiding prompt injection in the metadata and letting that get slurped into your agent. And at that point, you're kind of up a creek. And that one, there are lots of mitigations around that, but it's way more complex prompt engineering that involves separating out untrusted data that you're processing from the core of the instruction processing that the agent does. And so I don't think any of these systems are tackling that yet because that's still pretty hard science to get that to maintain the quality you want, basically without letting the core decision engine ever actually see the untrusted content. So there's a whole lot of security problems with OpenClaw. I think this mitigates some of them, but fundamentally, they're not ones that couldn't be mitigated in the open.
Aaron, do you want to talk a little bit about kind of the competitive dynamics here? You know, everybody's getting into this space. Perplexity, I think, was an early player that had like a lot of action. And I think it is trying to figure out how it kind of fits into the overall competition between, Anthropic and OpenAI and like the labs that are larger than it. I guess it is also trying to deal with the competition from below, right? Like that increasingly we will see a lot of kind of these agent tools popping up all of a sudden. And so it feels like even though it kind of got started in search, it sort of needs to kind of protect its flank in some ways. Are you ultimately kind of bullish on Perplexity or do you feel like they've got real trouble as we go?
I just wanted to talk a bit about the cost, right, of using this, right? Is that I looked at it and it looked like from just the surface, from what I could gather, that it is around $200 a month. Right, for the max tier. I mean, that's a lot for the average user, and I'm not quite sure what the cost value proposition is, right, for this. It kind of throws this whole system into question, right? And so some of it is a lot of marketing, right? Because whenever you read this, it says, hey, this will come run your business for you. That's mostly marketing, right? It's a fully autonomous project management. That's very inflated as far as what it can actually do. And broad accessibility, the cost alone, I think, is not for the average user. Right. So I think those three areas point that this is definitely hype. But on the other hand, it does have some real value. Right. And Tim, I'll get back to your question about, what the competition is. Right. So I wanted to mention that some of this is real work and research behind the scenes, right? So I was going through to see what is real, right? So there's some papers and academia. One example is a deep learning framework for optimal agent selection. Right, by Kushagara, right? There's another one like the manager agent as a unifying research challenge, right? So that's real science engineering that's been peer reviewed and published, right? And so lots of this work, is built around that, which has been, years in the development. So that's great, right? That gives us a foundation within science and engineering. But on the other hand, the competition is there and real, right? I mean, I think Perplexity Computer, it's best for this no code, maybe this multi-step workflows, right, that we're seeing. But now there's Claude Cowork, right, that's out there, right, which is great for, I think, deep reasoning and, you know, doing these different tasks, you know, where you help it. There's OpenClaw, which could be great, like a good personal autonomous agent. LangGraph, one of my personal favorites because I like to get in the weeds, right? But that's best for custom workflows where you can build an agent of graphs that communicate. And then the last one that sort of pops, you know, to my mind is AutoGPT, which is best for autonomous task execution. So the space of around this orchestration and building something that can manage a team, it's getting a bit crowded, you know, but this might, you know, with the underlying, hopefully the underlying engineering and science, you know, that's there backed up by academia can help push the field a bit further.
Yeah, that's right. So you almost feel like there's still like a lot of niches here potentially to be filled.
Yeah. And I think they have a lot to prove out, you know, that this isn't just hype at scale, but this is an actual practical usage that can be used. And there isn't that much, you know, too many users yet that have given feedback. You know, it's very limited. And so I'm curious how that uptake is going to be. But, you know, on the other side, it does look interesting and promising, you know, and potentially could be a nice incremental step, right, going forward.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Interesting feature launch that popped out, I think just in the past week. So Claude announced that, Anthropic announced that you can now import memory into Claude. And I mentioned this because it might sound initially for some of you listeners as kind of like a minor feature. But for a very long time, I feel like there was kind of an article of faith that memory was going to be a big moat if you were running a chatbot. So the idea is, well, you know, once you've used ChatGPT extensively in your life for X amount of time, it would have a really deep memory of you and what you want and what you can do. And it's really hard to just pick that up and move that, right? And so in the same way that like email has this like very long history that is very difficult to kind of migrate effectively, you know, memory was a moat for these chatbots, particularly as, you know, maybe models commodify. And so I think this is actually really, you know, Anthropic's introduction of Claude and its import memory feature is kind of interesting in this respect because it kind of says, well, maybe in the future we will actually just be able to like pick up memory and move it to another chatbot and just pick up where we left off. And so maybe what we thought was a moat is a moat no longer. And so I guess, Chris, maybe I'll kick it over to you first is like, should we kind of see actually like that maybe it's actually going to be much more competitive than we thought and that this kind of back history is not really going to be a limiter to people just picking up a model that they like, putting it down when they don't like it and moving their stuff over to a new provider?
I don't think it's as big a deal as people think it is. I mean, actually, probably the bigger deal is my full chat history as opposed to necessarily what's being stored in the memory itself. That's probably what I'm more interested in. You know, can it remember my name? Can it remember, you know, where I went to school or whatever? Yeah, well, boohoo, right? What's probably more interesting for me is that, you know, I'm deep in this thing and I'm like, I did this 6 months ago or whatever. Search my chat history, go find me, whatever I was thinking at that point, right? So it's, for me, it's less about the memories and it's more about the chat history. And sure, you can use the import memory to go and find the things that are important, but I still sort of feel that that's dynamic in need. I mean, the other one is like, well, I think we're just going to switch anyway. Do you know what I mean? I was like, I'm a big Claude user. I think I'm not going to pretend otherwise. Everybody knows that. I use ChatGPT a lot for fast search stuff, whereas I tend to use Claude for more deep thinking and I use it for code, et cetera, right? I don't think the memory thing is just such a big deal. Do you know what I mean? But I can imagine if I... not think of myself, but if I start to think of all the people who have been forming relationships and made chat bot boyfriends and girlfriends and, you know, and all of the backlash of GPT-4.0, I suspect that is a big thing there, right? Which is if you can, you know, maybe that's the use case they've tested. Maybe they're like, okay, GPT-4.0, if we can restart on Claude and that can be your new AI chat friend, then maybe that's the market. So I'm not convinced I'm the target audience, but I think there's a whole set of people who is the target audience, and if that works for them, then they can have their calls playing chatbot do whatever. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. Aaron is like, I always joke with my wife. I'm always like, how long do you cook chicken thighs? And I have this conversation with OpenAI from like 6 months ago that I just refer to because it has that fact really easily available. It is true that I feel like my experience of it lines up a little bit like with Chris, where, you know, maybe it's not so much memory, but more just kind of like, oh, here's like a really nice document for the thing that I need. And I keep going back to that document repeatedly. So I don't know, Aaron, are you a big memory kind of booster here? Or are you kind of similarly like, this is like maybe at the margin, but not really that big of a competitive change?
Yeah, I think Chris makes some great points there. You know, I think for me, the tagline is that this, you know, this memory, it makes AI systems portable, you know, that you're accumulated context and what it knows about you, it can move with you. So it reduces that friction of trying to, you know, change models. Although that's not really friction for lots of people that I know that use these models. You know, it's mostly like we have these mixture of experts or ensemble of models that we, you know, federate to and then get back results in these complex workflows, right? So I'm not sure if that competitive mode is really going to be all that relevant per se, right? Going into the future. I did want to bring up you know something a little different than what you asked him was, you know, this idea of memory poisoning, right? Is that, you know, there's a lot of fake news out there. You know, you can corrupt and inject, you know, information about somebody, anybody that's not true, right? And then, you know, it becomes a very false or misleading export or a dump of the data of what a model knows about you. Or, you know, you can have a search tool like DuckDuckGo that goes out and gets information about you that isn't right. Right. So you're basically poisoning, right, the data/memory, exporting that. And then you could use that as context into another model. And it just amplifies the poisoning because now this other model now, you know, gets the poisoning from a tool that maybe a different model didn't have access to, or it wasn't a tool usage type model. Right. So you're just, you know, moving this sort of virus of data, you know, from one model to another model to another model becomes this, you know, pandemic, all right, spread of viral data. Right. So, you know, so, I mean, that's what I was really thinking about, you know, about this is, you know, and it's an open question, but how can we contain this memory poisoning attack, right, throughout all these others? And that, to me, is what the biggest concern was. But circling back, you know, I don't know exactly how relevant this memory export is really going to be, right, coming into the future or how big of a play it's going to be when you can just connect memories together, you know, where they would share data anyways. But that's where my thought process was going.
Well, maybe, I don't know, Gabe, do you want to make the
I had so many thoughts on this one.
Yeah, no, please go. Yeah, because so, I feel like what I'm hearing from Chris and Aaron is nothing burger. This is we shouldn't even
be
talking
okay.
about this.
I think this specific instance is kind of a nothing burger, but I actually think there's a much more important conversation to be had here. But the first reaction I had to this, honestly, was like, I took my kids to get a haircut last night and I walked by a Verizon store and out front they had a sign that said, bring us your bill from AT&T and T-Mobile and we'll give you a better deal. And I was like, cool, same. And then I actually read this article and the implementation of this that Anthropic has rolled out is literally prompt engineering. It's put this prompt into your agent of choice that says, please, please, please give me all my memories. Please, please, please format in a way that Claude will do it, please. And hopefully ChatGPT will comply nicely. And then you could just copy and paste right on over to Claude. How long before ChatGPT says, hey, cool, I know how to guard against that one. It's against our terms of use. Sorry, not going to do it. So anyway, I just kind of laughed at the implementation of this because
right,
fundamentally—
Right, and it's not like a formal export. It's just like you like beg the model
this
to
is
give
like,
you the
please,
memory.
Please, 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 all caps, important, colon. Like, you know, it's the same old
no
stuff we've been doing. Make no mistakes, exactly. Now, the thing that I actually think this brings up for me that is actually exactly what you guys were both referencing, which is sort of this divide on memory and who's using it, who's not, and what responsible use of memory actually could and should be. So the interesting thing is that I think everyone on this podcast is a pretty technical person by nature, and we all, myself included, lean pretty far away from making memory a core piece of our workflow. I think that has to do with how we see AI as essentially an ephemeral atomic thing that we interact with exactly when we want to interact with it and no time else. And therefore, we want full control over what context it's seeing in any given session. I don't want it pulling up random stuff I talked about before when I'm talking about something else. I want to own that session. I think we are probably the exception to the general public. I think there are many people out there who do have a much deeper personal relationship and expect that memory to hold on and sort of cross-pollinate across chats. So I think there's an interesting divide on basically your user persona. But if we think about the folks who live more on that leaning on memory side, and if I think about where I would hypothetically like to lean on memory, there's an ownership question here. And this is why I think the implementation that Anthropic has here is kind of so almost funny in its nature. They're not actually like giving you any control, although I guess they do allow you to see the memories they have stored about you and edit them. So that's kind of nice. But what I think the actual next step is independent memory that is vendor agnostic. I mean, I use probably 3 to 4 different agents at any given day, depending on which one I'm out of tokens for and how complex the task is. And I don't use memory in any of them, but if I did, I would want it to be memory that is completely independent of all of them that I own and I can edit and I can share or limit as I see fit. Again, going back to the ownership side of things. On the other side of the fence, people that are using these things more just as personal, either assistants or companions or whatever, there is also sort of an ownership and privacy element here. And I think if you think about, some of the data laws that exist throughout the world, particularly GDPR, this right to own your own data is something that we've talked a lot about in different contexts, not necessarily AI. So I think there's a real future where a person should be able to own their own AI memory independent of the vendor, and it should be vendor neutral. So you can, it's not a switch back and forth. It's that here's my memories. Today I'm going to use those memories with ChatGPT as the brain. Today I'm going to use them with Perplexity as the brain. Today I'm going to use them with Claude as the brain. And today I'm going to use them with open code running on my laptop, local models. And it's all one big happy memory that I own and I can edit. So,
but you can do that today, Gabe. I mean,
you can. Yes.
Yeah. You can literally create an MCP server which hooks back into memory. They all support MCP, Claude ChatGPT, and then switch 100%. Memories off in both. But people aren't going to do that because there's a technical barrier for you to do that, and it comes out of the box anyway in these platforms. But technically, you can do that.
Yes. Now, I think. I could wax poetic on thoughts about memory for a long time because I think there are many technical barriers to it right now. And MCP, the big challenge is that the model has to opt into that memory, right? It has to explicitly choose to go recall a fact or store a fact. Whereas there are also memory systems that can be essentially background processes that curate an entire conversation in the background and allow that to be injected as additional context alongside without necessarily having the model need to invoke a tool. So there's a lot of different memory architectures. I think it's a very unexplored space. But you're absolutely right. Today, this, memories are locked behind vendors because vendors have their own implementations of them. But going back to your whole premise of this conversation, Tim, I do think memory as a moat is no more, right? Like, I think this is gone. This is going to go away very quickly. I think it will still be a stickiness factor for folks that don't care to assert this type of ownership over their memories. But I think as a tactical moat, there's no fundamental reason why memory should be any different than anything else in this ecosystem that is, the same shape of problem that you can move from one place to the other.
Yeah, just like as plug and play. That's interesting. Great. Well, a lot more to talk about there. We're going to keep an eye on that. I do want to get into this more in future episodes of MOE. Just like, I guess the question of just like memory, what it knows, how it should be structured, whether or not it should be interoperable, like I think is like very, very interesting. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. There's a little bit of a meme that some of you may have be familiar with online where people take the old vintage video game Doom, and they try to put Doom on like smaller and smaller and more counterintuitive devices. And so someone's been able to get Doom to run on like a refrigerator and like all sorts of things. And so, I don't know, I was kind of like, my eye got caught by this kind of fun story about a project called Null Claw, which basically attempts to do AI agents and an AI agent framework, but at incredibly small scale. And so what they do here is Null Claw is, I think it's 678 kilobytes. It runs on 1 megabyte of RAM and boots in 2 milliseconds. It's like really, really tiny implementation of agents. And it got me thinking, actually, because, you know, I would say the trend that we were talking about last year was very much along the lines of, well, models are getting better and better, and they're also getting smaller and smaller. And that really changes where we can put these things. And it seems like, I mean, Null Claw is a little conceptual at the moment, but it kind of feels like we may go through the same thing with agent frameworks as well, Chris, where it just kind of feels like eventually you'll just be able to get an agent running on like really, really low power edge devices, which I'm still thinking through the implications of that, but is different from how I've thought about this, like from the era of like, you have to go buy a Mac Mini and that's how you try to do this thing.
I think boo to Null Claw. That's where I'm starting. Boo. Right. I mean, well, I'm picking that for a reason, which is Null Claw. Yeah, they're going, oh, 768K. This is amazing. Blah, 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 blah. And then you're like, yeah, but you're not covering the inference. You're connecting into the same old frameworks that we have before. You need Llama. You need Llama CPP. You need the OpenAI. You know, so what are you optimizing? You're optimizing the for loop. I'm like, well, thanks. I appreciate it. But the reality is, you know, that's it. And then you're going, well, I don't need a virtual machine like you go with Go, etc. They're comparing themselves to Rust. They're going, oh, yeah, you know. And you're like, well, Rust is as native as you can get. What are you on about? I get it. You wrote it in Zig. I've written Zig code. Zig is cool. I've written Rust code, etc. You're not focusing on the right thing. If you were turning around and saying, I put Zig on there, and by the way, I've also taken Carpathia's NanoGPT, and then I've rewritten all of that in Zig, and therefore you can do pure inference, and then I'd be like, yeah, you guys rock. But no, you're saying, you know, I've written a better wrapper than the other people wrote their wrappers. I'm good. We need better wrappers. I'm all for that. It is a good thing. And I think you're absolutely right. These frameworks are going to get smaller. They're going to get better. You know, but it is ultimately a wrapper. And I say this as somebody who has written a wrapper himself. Do you know what I mean? And the comparison against the Mac Mini, this runs on a Mac Mini, but I can run it over here. And you're like, TypeScript is not the reason you need a Mac Mini for OpenClaw, right? The reason you need a Mac Mini there is because you're doing inference on the machine. And Mac Minis do that really well. You ain't running inference on your little $5 whatever you're running that thing on, right? So I think we got to separate a little bit of the hype. Is what they're saying coming? Are models going to get smaller? Is inference going to get faster? Yes, Carpathia's really proved that. The stuff he's doing there is amazing, right? And therefore, I do think in that world, and even the latest Macs, for example, you now have the SDKs, you can access the silicon directly. That is cool. This future is coming. Is it Null Claw? I applaud them. Great. You've written a super fast wrapper, but there's so much more to this. And I think I think marketing hype has let them down over the thing they've actually built, because the thing they've built is actually cool. But all the marketing comparisons, it's just not fair.
Yeah. All right. Right. I cannot catch a break with the stories today. It feels like
no.
Import memory shot down. You know, like Null Claw shot down. I mean, let's maybe zoom out. I mean, because I think like it's true that, Chris, what you're describing, the kind of ideal version of this where everything is really, really small, is coming in my mind. And I guess maybe Null Claw aside, I think we put the nail in the coffin on that story.
It's but still I guess cool. I do like Null Claw. I'm just
being sure.
I'm just being a bit mean.
But Gabe, it looks like you might want to jump in. Is like, let's just talk a little bit about like minimization in agents, right? Because that certainly will happen, right?
So you know, I'm definitely not as harsh on this story as Chris is, but I do think the point he's making is really important, that the word local is an overloaded word, right? And you have to be very careful about what is local and what is not, right? This Null Claw is not Pico Claw, Nano Claw, none of the claws, actually even Open Claw, none of them are explicitly running the inference locally. So fundamentally, you can run Open Claw on a Raspberry Pi if you want. It's just you can't run the models, right? So that's important. The thing that I think actually is interesting about Null Claw specifically is to me, it's a sort of a, it's an analogy of how many limbs and what's the degree of connectivity for your agent surface, right? So I think there's sort of a, on one end of the spectrum, you can imagine we've got huge frontier models that have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of agents running off of them on every device everywhere in the world. On the other extreme, you have fully encapsulated, you know, air-gapped agents that have the model inference, the wrapper logic, the tools, and the only thing that they're necessarily reaching out for is additional context in whatever, you know, domain they're given, whether it's the local area network, whether it's full internet access for search, et cetera. But the actual, you know, business logic and compute for those agents is fully centralized. And then you could imagine something sort of somewhere in the middle, which is a little bit where I'm, you know, setting my local setup up. I've got a GB10 device where I can run some pretty decent sized models. And now I've got a bunch of different devices on my local network that are talking to that GB10 device. So I'm not beholden to, you know, the top level frontier models, but I'm also not trying to squeeze, you know, extremely powerful models onto my 7-year-old Android phone or something smaller. So where I think Nullclaw is really interesting is that it goes even further into the smallest possible footprint that the sort of edge of these systems could live on. Now, why is that valuable? It's only valuable if that edge device actually has some novelty that the other devices this thing is going to run on don't. So that could be cost. Like if you could literally run this thing for $5, that's pretty accessible. It could be sensors, right? So this could certainly plug into something that has sensor data coming into it, whether it's a, you know, IoT device that's hooked up to a door cam or a temperature sensor or whatever. So you could certainly imagine a world where this is relevant to like home automation or business automation. And getting this into like microcontrollers could be pretty cool. So I think the larger architecture that this implies is pretty interesting. You know, I think this specific one, you know, everyone's just trying to get OpenClaw as small as possible. And it goes back to the earlier questions that I raised about Perplexity Computer. Like, it doesn't actually solve the core problems of OpenClaw other than the physical size and speed of the code base, right? And that is one aspect that could be improved, but it's not anywhere close to all of them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I were to zoom out to the conceptual level of this story, I think it's really interesting because we're trying to go from these cloud giants to edge swarms, you know, and it's like the era of everyone's device is now AI capable, right? But then when we zoom down into the details, I think we've collectively brought up, you know, issues and challenges that need to be solved. So even if the inference challenge was solved, there's still going to be, well, and the infrastructure costs drop with GPU usage, there's still going to be network costs. Those are going to go up, right? So is that network cost going to offset that? Because you're going to have, you know, this plurality of messaging, message volume, bandwidth, you know, requirements, right? So, you know, I think the economics, right, it just shifts, you know, around. And we just need to better understand how that's going to work. And whenever I think about this, you know, with swarms in general, you know, I think about ants, you know, and you're probably wondering, what do ants, insects have to do with this, you know? But, I always go back to ant colony optimization. Right, where an ant is an agent. It's very simple. It's very small. It doesn't need a lot of power to run. But the idea is to optimize a colony of ants such that these agents can work together, right? And it's a big swarm of nests, you know, that move around and, you know, have smaller consumption of power, right? And they're very strong with their sensors. So their mandible is very strong of which they can, what they can do. And so that metaphor of going into this swarm of agents to me really made it interesting, you know, where if you look through the lens of biology to understand how you could optimize an ant colony, that perhaps we could take some of those techniques and, you know, move this a bit further. Now that, again, that's very, you know, conceptual, you know, but there is a lot of work around that. My last thought that I wanted to bring up too, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, in the past, what does this remind me of? You know, this reminds me of lab on a chip, right? Where, you know, you would take a chip and then you would be able to add in, you know, ways of parallelizing chemical processes all at once, right? So it was like orchestrating the way of which thousands of these chemicals can run, you know, and lab on a chip, it is very different than what's being proposed here, but it has structural similarity where you have multiple agents that are very small that work and run together. Lab on a chip, you had, you know, these small sensors that was an entire lab that ran together, you know, so I think this, you know, creating this combinatorial scale, right, is important. But we need to dig down and how are we really going to do that, you know, and figure out how is this really about swarms for intelligence, right? And we can create these many small autonomous processes.
All right, final story of the day will be kind of a fun story. This crossed across NBC News and a couple of the news channels. There's a company called Particle 6. Which made a big announcement that it was going to, you know, launch the world's first AI actor, a character by the name of Tilly Norwood. And this created a bunch of controversy. The Screen Actors Guild, you know, basically put out a press release bashing the company for doing this. But the dream is ultimately to create kind of an end-to-end, totally virtual character that will be a celebrity in all the ways that are meaningful for a celebrity to operate. So they envision that Norwood will be in movies and doing interviews and otherwise kind of being like a celebrity in the same way that, you know, any other kind of movie celebrity might operate. I guess, Chris, I'll throw it over to you again on whether or not you think this is for real or for hype.
I'm all in.
You're defying expectations, but go ahead. Yeah, Chris.
No, I am all in on this. If I really think about it, is, you know, why do we need movie actors in the first place? And I know I'm probably opening up a bigger can of worms there, but you got a movie. I mean, theoretically, you could put any actor in there, right? And it's like, because they're meant to be playing a character. Why does it need to be Tom Cruise? Why does it need to be, I can't think of any other actors other than Tom Cruise, that guy that supports the Philly Eagles, that guy. Right? Why, you know, it's because we form a connection with it. You're like, I like Tom Cruise movies. It's action stunts, it's whatever, you know, a few quips or whatever. And then we all feel good and it's a good time. And then I think about the pop industry, that's kind of already happened. Like, I think of like the Gorillaz, you know, where the Damon Albarn guy, you know, this is like 20 years ago, he formed effectively an avatar type band, right? Where they play in these characters all the time, the cartoons. And that became a huge band. But underneath the hood, it's still Damon Albarn. But we form this emotional connection with those characters. And then when we watch movies, we form emotional connections with the characters. I was watching like that latest Thor movie, and then there was like the rock guy in there. Not the rock, but the guy that looks like a rock. And he was really funny. And you're like, yeah, I like seeing him in different movies. But you know, it's just a bit of CGI with a voice. And so logically, when we get to Tilly Norwood and we're going to have these AI-generated movies, then from a consistency perspective, we're going to want to see the same characters in different movies because of familiarity, the same voice. How is Tilly going to do this in here? And we already see this with video games as well, right? You see the same characters coming back. So and then, and like, even Barbie does movies, you know, you've seen, you know, or, you know, Barbie in whatever island, Barbie in the Three Musketeers, Disney characters do it. Like, here's Mickey Mouse in
I, for one, know, have not the seen Three Barbie Musketeers. In the Three Musketeers.
But yeah, exactly. So with Mickey Mouse, the Muppets do Treasure Island and Christmas Carol, why can't? So I think it's not unreasonable. Is Tilly Norwood any different from a Muppet when we think about it? Probably not. So I'm all in. I think this is going to be huge. I'm all for it.
Yeah, for Gabe and Chris, you know, do you think Tilly could win or be associated with an Oscar?
I think her range is probably as good as some of the other people.
Gabe, what do you think about?
So
would you be opposed to it? If Tilly won an Oscar,
I'm gonna not answer the question yet. I'll get there. I think Chris, you're pointing out something really interesting about this. But I think both of you are pointing to the question of whether is Tilly the character or is Tilly the actor? It's basically like, is this a meta character that we are now trying to create? And your question, Aaron, is basically, well, should that meta character have the properties of the meta characters in reality, right? Because we aren't giving, Oscars to the actual characters on screen. We're giving it to the actors that portray those characters, right? And so, of course, this crosses the uncanny valley into, like, are we personifying this pile of bits and prompting in a way that we shouldn't? You know, I'm probably less bullish on that personification. So I probably would have some personal qualms with Tilly getting an Oscar, only because I think we have to just tread really lightly in this world of AI about how much we allow things to be personified. I mean, it just brings up all sorts of the standard playing God morality questions that we're all dancing around in this industry, right? You know, I'm listening to a really interesting podcast on the side that went all the way down the rabbit hole of this called The Shell Game. And it's talking about somebody trying to run their own company with completely AI-generated employees. But he went all the way down the rabbit hole and gave them personas and voices and let them, you know, hallucinate their own backstories. And then he gets annoyed at them. He gets frustrated with their behaviors. And I think this whole trying to create a personification for an AI entity that then acts in a role that is not, you know, that is derived from their personification, but not necessarily purely their personification. It's a level of personification that I think we just have to be careful about as an industry.
Chris, I don't think we do need to be careful. We just need to go all in on this. It's all fine.
Chris,
no qualms.
Well, that's yep. Just go all in and don't worry about it. It'll be fine. certainly one option. But Aaron, I stole your response. So that's my take on this.
Yeah. And Aaron, I would actually maybe point the question back at you for our final comment of the episode. I mean, you've done a lot of fan experiences, but I think one thing that you haven't really gotten into is the idea that, like, the AI becomes a participant in the thing. And so kind of curious if you have kind of reservations about this at all.
Well, so say Tilly did win, you know, an Oscar, you know, or was associated with an Oscar, you know, I think that would prove that, you know, Tilly, that we don't need a soul to win an Oscar, that just a bunch of algorithms could win, right? And first, I don't think that could happen with the guardrails that are in, you know, the SAG would be all over this, right? They'd be very upset, you know, because they claim, you know, it's not a human real actor, has no life experience, no emotions. There's no real human contribution, although you could say there is human contribution here, right? But they do recognize creative authorship, right? To protect, you know, job displacement, you know, job losses, right? And you know, and making sure there's that human touch, you know, still there, right? So that's what today is about, right? And then, you know, I was thinking about, you know, well, Tilly is a one-way performance, right? It doesn't react or take in, you know, any sorts of stimulus and do something, right? Whereas, you know, we had this company called Soul Machines, which did, right, where you could, you know, have a full two-way interaction with the Soul Machine, and in essence, where Tilly is mostly about this algorithm or set of algorithms going out and behaving in certain ways, right, to star maybe within a set of movies, right? We'll have to see how that goes. But, you know, do we just let this happen, right? It's kind of, so I know Chris is all in. Gabe is very cautious. I tend to be on the cautious side as well, you know, because, there's so many challenges about, you know, what about consenting, likeness, right, and image, you know, authenticity, deception, who owns the creative piece? What if there's bias?
Tilly owns a creative piece. Weren't you listening, Aaron?
possibly. It's going to be interesting whenever law begins to catch up with some of the tech. That said, on the intellectual property side, you know, there's lots of, so the term agent is very different here, but there's a lot of IP agents, right? Which are humans, right? And then there's IP lawyers, right, that are grappling a lot with this because there's inventors that are using a lot of these tools to create claims, right, that are like real estate lines to protect. But I'm finding myself going off on a tangent here. Let's go back to Tilly. It'll be interesting.
Chris, sounds like you may want to get a final comment in.
Well, my final comment is the mistake they made was telling people about it. What they should have done is just made the movie, put Tilly in it, not told anyone, get nominated for the Oscar, do a bit of a weekend Bernie's every time they want to ask her, just, oh, no, till he stepped out, and then, you know, she'll be back later or whatever, and then win the Oscar and then go, surprise everybody, woohoo. That's how you should have done it. But then they were like, oh no, look, we've done an AI actor, you know. They got it wrong. Yeah.
But yeah. I would love to see you know, systems to do like liveness detection. You know, is this a live human or not, right? And if it passes that Turing 3.0 test of, you know, can we determine whether this Tilly is human or not, that would be a really interesting experiment to see.
Fellas, it's always interesting. I love having this panel. Gabe, Aaron, Chris, thanks for your time. That's all the time that we have for today. So thanks for joining, all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.